you got success through a team. You go through failure as a team. You rise back out of it through a team. You're not alone. Often when people go through adversity, they personalize it to what they could have done differently or what's wrong in their life or in their career. The more you can externalize it and share that experience with others, it not only brings other people along, but you actually benefit from shared objectives and really leveraging each other's strengths. That really makes a team much stronger than any one individual, and reinforcing that throughout the entire company, you're not alone. It's always been easier to make it through something when you're doing it together.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer.
And I'm Roman Segal, recovering marketer. Andrew and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we both had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know but want to know more about, how they got their start, how they make it work, and what keeps them going.
It's kind of like bringing a microphone to a cup of coffee, or in my case, hot chocolate.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Tarang Amin, chairman and CEO of Elf Beauty. It was a really great conversation about the power of people and really just human connections. Here's a quick bio. Tarang is the chairman and CEO of Elf Beauty, which is the parent company to three brands, Elf Cosmetics, the clean beauty brand Well People, and Keys Soul Care, a lifestyle beauty brand created with Alicia Keys. Tarang has served in his current role at Elf since 2014, but he has more than 25 years of consumer products experience building brands, leading innovation, and assembling high-performance teams. Previously, Tarang served as the president and chief executive officer and director of Shift Nutrition, where he grew enterprise value from $190 million to $1.5 billion with brands like Airborne and MegaRed. Before Shift, Tarang served as VP and general manager of the Clorox company's $1.7 billion litter, food, and charcoal business. And of course, he began his career at Procter & Gamble, where he held various management positions for more than 11 years. Tarang earned his BA in international policy and MBA from Duke University, and him and his family live in the Bay Area and are committed to giving back. So, you know, one thing I really loved about talking to Tarang was just hearing about his personal story and how his innate curiosity propelled him throughout his career. He's always willing to make these leaps into bigger, sometimes unknown territory, be it his first job as a 14-year-old immigrant entrepreneur from African India, being featured in Business Week in a pretty unexpected way, or learning more in an afternoon store check with a mentor that you've probably heard of. But you know, what I love most about this conversation was what a great storyteller Tarang is, and hearing how generous he is with the time that he makes for his people, giving back to them, but also humbly learning from them as well. I think you're really going to enjoy our conversation with Tarang. Today, we're talking to Tarang Amin, chairman and CEO of Elf Beauty. Tarang, welcome to the podcast. It's really great to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Tarang, a lot of people know your professional story. You've been the CEO of Elf since 2014, but you've got more than 25 years of consumer products experience building brands, leading innovation, and assembling high-performance teams. You've taken brands from $50 million to $2 billion, and you've worked at companies like Elf, Shift Nutrition, Clorox, and you got your start at P&G. And there's so much in there I want to ask about, but I guess my first question is, who were you before the beginning of your career journey? Can you tell us a story from your youth?
Sure. So I'm an Indian immigrant. Both my parents were born and raised in India. I actually was born in East Africa. My dad used to work in Kenya. So I was born in Nairobi and spent part of my childhood in Kenya and Uganda. When Idi Amin came to power and kicked all the Asians out, we emigrated to the US and pretty much grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. And as you say, while most of my professional career has been in large consumer packaged goods companies, you know, I tell people a lot of what I learned about business was between the ages of 14 and my mid-20s. Because when I was, like many immigrants, the way we rose were as entrepreneurs. So when I was 14 years old, I remember we sold our house, we took every penny we had, and we bought our first motel on Route 1 in Alexandria, Virginia, moved right into the manager's apartment. And our business model as a family was we'd find these distressed properties, we'd fix them up, we were good operators, and we kept kind of building that business out till about my mid-20s, when my dad wanted to do nonprofit work. We ended up selling that business, and my parents have lived off of that ever since. And the reason why I tell the motel stories is really twofold. I found myself after grad school at P&G, which is a wonderful training ground, but I tell people a lot of what I learned about cash flow, economic profit, how you treat people, really came from those early entrepreneurial days and being able to take many of those skills to much larger scale businesses. And then I'd say the second reason why is about 10 years ago, I made the switch to these private equity backed mid-market growth companies. And while the industries are different, the scale is different, there's so many things that are reminiscent of our family entrepreneurial business in terms of the level of ownership people have, the speed at which we can move, the things that we can do. So it was obviously a very formative experience for me prior to even P&G, and I still carry a lot of those experiences forward.
I think I told you before we started recording, my mom was a refugee from East Africa as well. And so some of the stories, and I think the way it kind of shaped that whole generation is interesting. And I actually read something else that in your business school interview, you actually used your experience as a motel because they're like, you don't have traditional business experience.
Oh, that's right. I mean, I think I went to university at Duke and I did international policy. And I remember applying to the business school my senior year. And the dean, I had an interview with the dean of the business school. And he said, well, we don't take people straight out of undergrad. You have no business experience. And, you know, I looked at that as almost a challenge. I'm like, well, let me tell you about my business experience. And I think after about 20 or 30 minutes of me talking about the motel experience and everything that we had learned and done through that experience, I think he was convinced and he let me in. Now, I ended up working a couple of years between anyway, just because I wanted to see what international policy was all about. But yeah, no, it definitely, whenever anyone told me I didn't have experience, I would always point back to those early days and everything we learned there.
Well, I mean, many years on, how are you similar to that younger version of you, or how are you different?
Yeah, I'd say probably the biggest similarity is just innate curiosity. I mean, at 14 years old, I knew nothing about how to run a hospitality business. And a lot of that just came from really asking lots of questions, trying things, experimenting, figuring things out. And I feel like that's still very much part of my DNA. I ask at least 20 dumb questions a day, constantly seeking to kind of learn and understand. And I'd say that's probably the biggest area of similarity. And then I would say the second is just an inherent kind of scrappiness of let's go try something. Let's go do something on a smaller scale. Let's figure it out. So you're not mortgaging your entire business with a decision, but you're really learning along the way. And I'd say those are probably the two biggest similarities. And in terms of differences, I'd say probably the biggest difference is early in one's career, you tend to be very goal and achievement focused. And I certainly still am. But I'd say taking much more time to get to know the rest of the team and my peers and the curiosity of understanding their lives and what's important to them and just investing a lot more time in that. And I've just found much greater power than that than charging after a goal. I just found it's a much better way of kind of motivating people if you really got to know them and could give them really great feedback and take feedback in return. Just found it made the entire team better and it makes life more enjoyable as well.
Yeah, a constant theme as I've looked at your career is this kind of curiosity, and it's something I've started to value a lot in big companies and small. I guess eventually you wound up at P&G, you wound up at Clorox, at Schiff, and then Elf. But in those early years, were there any defining career moments, any stories or lessons that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. And I think some of the best were when things didn't work out right. I was fortunate. I was on Pantene in the early days of the relaunch and then did something unusual. I was on that business for 8 years. And during that 8-year period, I think we probably hit 4 different walls. So while we had great success and we took it from $50 million to $2 billion, I learned the most from those moments where you kind of hit a wall on a business and it made you kind of really step back and say, gosh, what did we miss? What are we doing wrong? What do we need to change? And I learned so much more from that. Probably even a bigger, more public kind of version of that was I was on Bounty. I was the marketing director on Bounty, and we're going through a pretty important turnaround on that business. P&G had gone through a CEO transition. I think Business Week was doing an article. And I remember that article like it was yesterday, and it was many years ago. And it basically, I think the subheader was something like, if you don't know what's wrong with P&G, you have to look no further than the Bounty business. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, this was a business that I was responsible for. So I had the normal human reaction of wanting to write a letter to the editor of everything that they got wrong and and everything there. And I remember going, A.G. Laffley was the CEO at the time, going to his office and just really apologetic of like, gosh, it was just a terrible article. I'm sorry. And I remember at the time he told me, Trang, don't worry about it. Nobody reads Business Week. You're doing the right thing. Stay focused on your plan. And it made me feel good for about an hour or so. And then I was driving home and I remember a neighbor, our next door neighbor, was right on the fence line going, Trang, man, that was a bad article. And I remember thinking, oh, no. Like, wait a minute. People do read Business Week. And, you know, while you wanted to kind of crawl under the covers and kind of wished it went away, I realized, like, you know, if I'm feeling this bad, other people on our team are probably feeling this way. So I remember writing a note to the entire team on the Bounty Business Week article and talking about, while there are certain things they got wrong, there are a number of things that they did get right and that reinforced the strategy we're on. And I remember it was an important moment of a real kind of punch to your gut and kind of saying, all right, what do we take away from this and what can we do? And you're really proud that we were able to be successful in that turnaround. I think we grew sales on Bounty over $300 million after tax profit, over $100 million during that period. I think it was that period when we were at our lowest that in some respects became the most important, where it really caused us to step back and really take a look and see what we're doing and what we had to do differently. So, and you probably don't have enough time on this podcast for all the other different failures or setbacks over time. And I feel like in every single one of them, that ability to kind of step back and say, okay, what can I learn from this? What can we do? And it's not early in my career. I mean, still, 2018 for e.l.f. Beauty was not a great year. This is a business that we've had in our 16-year history, 15 years of really strong growth. We were down 3% in 2018, and it really caused me, gosh, almost 30 years in the consumer space to step back and say, okay, what did I miss? What do we miss as a team? What do we need to reinforce in terms of our strategy? And happy to say, since that time, we've now had 8 consecutive quarters of growth and are actually picking up a lot of share in a category that's challenged. But I always look at those moments first and foremost where things didn't go right to really crystallize thinking and what we have to go do.
Well, and I love how you went straight into those kind of almost like crystallizing moments, because I guess I want to ask a question about the context of some of those, right? So the Bounty Laffley story is really interesting. Nobody reads Business Week and everybody read it. And 2018, and this is more about context and reaction, because now you are in the AG seat, right, at e.l.f. The market and the press came after you guys, and lots of leaders have to deal with, whether you're at a startup and your board and your investors or activist investors, how do you tune out the noise and focus on the business when people are coming after you or people are being hypercritical of things when they don't see the full picture? How do you find that focus?
Well, I think you have to have this core compass in terms of what is it that you're trying to do. And in e.l.f. Beauty's case, we have a mission of making the best of beauty accessible to every eye, lip, and face. And so really getting back to that core mission and saying, okay, that's the most important thing. Now, what's our strategy to help fulfill that mission? Where are we making progress? Where are we not? And kind of really systematically going through that. So I'd say one is just really making sure you don't let the noise interfere with the main plan of what you have to do. I'd say the second, probably one of the most important constituencies, is the team and making sure the team's focused on the right things, that you're getting the right feedback, that you're getting the right, everyone bringing kind of their best talents and in a very diverse team, really leveraging that. And then the stakeholders, other stakeholders take care of themselves. I mean, that comes from normal just communication. And I think it's one of the things I always look back in my career at P&G of, it's just such a great training ground of how do you communicate in different ways and be able to communicate with a number of different stakeholders. And I think that's served well, whether now, whether it's public investors, whether it's my board, whether it's beauty editors, there's a number of different people that constancy of purpose in terms of your mission, the reinforcing the strategies and what you're about and keeping your eye on that. I've always found that the noise kind of takes care of itself and then reinforces what you're trying to do.
Another thing I'm just actually really curious about is you've been at these big public companies, but then when you join e.l.f., it was from a private equity perspective. What's the difference between almost like the culture and the approach of private equity versus large CPGs? Because you've kind of threaded that needle really interestingly in your career.
Yeah, well, my first experience making that switch was from Clorox, where I was an executive, to my first role as a CEO was Shift Nutrition. And so I was recruited by TPG, the large private equity company in San Francisco. They had taken a stake in that company. And I knew I wanted to run a company. I liked the space of kind of nutritionals and health and wellness. And so I thought it would be a good opportunity. And I'd say probably there are more similarities than dissimilarities. I mean, the discipline you have in any big public company and everything that you've learned, all of those skills are applicable. I'd say the two biggest differences is often in time frame, often in private equity investments. You know, they want to return money to their LPs in kind of 3 to 5 years, ideally. So it really does condense a lot of the timing, things that you might take a much longer view at. Even if you are building things for the long term, the pace at which you have to move in many respects is more reminiscent of our family hospitality business and sometimes large matrix organizations. So I'd say that's probably one of the biggest differences, just the speed that you have to move. And then the second is you don't have the same level of resource. And so back to that thing of being scrappy and, yeah. And exactly, and building a team. And it's not P&G, it's not Clorox. So how are you convincing people to come join Shift Nutrition, which they may not have heard of? They may know the brands in terms of Airborne, Mega Red, Move Free, and some of the key brands, but they certainly don't know the company nearly as well. And so how do you assemble that team really from scratch in many respects and in a very kind of fast pace and make sure you have the right people and you're putting the right strategies in place? So I'd say those are probably the two biggest differences. But in terms of skill set, I feel like between P&G and Clorox, I'd picked up all the consumer and core business skills that I needed. And so it was really then just really applying it in a different setting. And again, I'll go all the way back to my motel days. That probably came in handy just as much as some of the large CPG experience did. And Shift Nutrition, that investment we were at for probably a little bit over 2 years. I think we built up the enterprise value there from about $180 million to $1.5 billion. We ended up selling that company to Reckitt Benckiser. Elf now has been longer. I've been the CEO of Elf for about six years.
Yeah.
And in Elf's case, it was a small private company. And
helped ring the bell, right?
Yeah, I did. We did. I think the original thesis was we'd build it up and then sell it to one of the large strategics. But as we got into the business, there's so many different areas, whether it was the consumer, what we could do from a distribution standpoint, from an innovation standpoint, an operation standpoint, that we felt, wow, we have really such a great long-term trajectory here. So we decided to take the company public. So in about 4 years ago, we took the company public and it was a great experience. We had to do quite a bit to kind of build the company up and everything you had to do to kind of get it to be a public company. But it gave us the ability of not only returning really great returns to our shareholders in terms of their liquidity, but gives us now a platform that we can build for the future.
Well, in some of these, I don't want to call them lesser known companies because they have massive brands, but the benefit of a big company, say a Procter or a Clorox, is you kind of, when you join, you inherit the reputation and the culture, and you could draft off of that. You can work within that framework, but at these smaller companies, be they startups, private equity brands, reputation and culture are being built on the runway as you're running down the runway with every new hire. And I think that's where it's really important that you've talked about curiosity, but something I know you're passionate about as well is diversity of your team. And I guess my question is this, like, we all know that diversity is a competitive advantage of work and life. How have you approached it as you built these companies, as you built these cultures, you built these reputations?
Yeah, well, I think one of the great luxuries of these mid-market growth companies is you are building the team at a rapid pace. So Elf is still a small company from a total number of employees standpoint. I think we have a total of 250 employees, but we've hired 200 and I think 42 of those employees. So we've had the incredible luxury of handpicking every single person in the company. Now, we tend to follow a similar profile of many of the people that we hire tend to come from blue chip consumer or beauty companies, but want to just move at a faster pace. But the other thing I would say is we can be much more thoughtful in terms of the diversity and inclusion that we want. And so, as I mentioned earlier, if our mission is making the best of beauty accessible to every eye, lip, and face, it was important to me that our employee base and our board reflected the consumers that we serve. So I'm really proud of the fact that our employee base is 75% women, over 60% Gen Z or millennial, over 40% diverse. They're the very young, diverse core beauty enthusiasts we aim to serve. And similarly on our board, I'm really proud of the fact that we're one of, I think it's only 10 public companies out of nearly 4,800 in the US that have more than 60% females on their board and over 40% diversity. And again, that didn't just happen. It was quite intentional. And it was from the belief that you just talked about, that, you know, every situation where I've seen diverse, high-performing teams, the performance was significantly better than other teams. And so it's something that we've been not only quite deliberate about, but are also quite proud and feel that it's one of our core advantages.
I guess a lot of our audience kind of fit that profile. They're rising professionals who are diverse and have faced professional adversity because of their background. And I guess my question is, what have your experiences been here throughout your career or with people that you've managed? What counsel, coaching, and advice do you give people facing adversity based on who they are?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it comes back to being true to who you are and having that confidence of there wasn't one person I worked with at P&G that I didn't think was really good and talented. Same with Clorox. And many of these environments I've been in, just been surrounded by really great people. And so I would say just reinforcing that you're also one of those really great people. And so when something goes wrong, it's just a great, great opportunity. I mean, you can look at it and you can kind of beat yourself up, or you can say, look, I inherently am good. I'm better than this. What can I learn from this? And what can I do differently? And I would say that one is on a personal level, but two, I found it equally important, or maybe even more so on a team level. And so I'd say probably one of the biggest learnings over time for me is you're not alone. Often when people go through adversity, they personalize it to kind of what they could have done differently or what's wrong in their life or in their career. And I've found that the more you can externalize it and share that experience with others, it not only brings other people along, but you actually benefit from kind of shared objectives and really leveraging each other's strengths. And it's also where the diversity comes into play, where I have a team, my executive team is incredibly talented, it's incredibly diverse, and we all complement each other's strengths. And so that really makes a team much stronger than any one individual. And reinforcing that throughout the entire company and with people you work with, I think is the second. I think a lot of times when people look at adversity, it's a very personal to themselves thing. I always done it where, no, it's in us, it's team. You got success through a team, you go through failure as a team, you rise back out of it through a team. And so that's probably the other dimension I'd give, which is you're not alone. Look at those peers around you, the people that have been supportive of you, the people that have different skill sets and tackle those problems together. It's always been easier to make it through something when you're doing it together.
So a lot of us face career forks in the road, these different inflection points where a decision you make kind of sets you on a path that you never could have imagined. What was one of those first ones for you?
I think probably one of the biggest ones for me was after business school, choosing P&G. I was very much focused in business school on international finance. I was, actually had an internship lined up at the World Bank and found my name on a brand management kind of closed interview list in business school. And to be honest, I didn't even know what P&G was. I mean, it sounds crazy.
I honestly thought they were a law firm in business school.
I knew there were some people from undergrad who joined them. And I remember at the time, almost derisively saying, well, I'm not going to go sell paper and detergent. And over time, I've sold pretty much every single major consumer sector. But I was curious. And part of what I loved about the P&G interview was it wasn't just about what I already knew. It was more about kind of what kind of leader was I? What were those experiences, whether it was being the head of tour guides at Duke or that earlier business experience? And that really intrigued me, the ability of going and trying to learn and at a young age, being able to manage a brand. And so out of curiosity, I went to Cincinnati and I structured my internship almost half the summer. I was going to be P&G, the other half of the World Bank. I ended up loving the consumer space. I ended up loving consumer goods. So that was a really important fork in the road. I think my mom was hoping I was going back to the DC area. She was really disappointed that I ended in Cincinnati instead. So I think that was one. I'd say a second was how long I was at P&G. I went there almost fully like the intention of many people do after business school of I'll go there for a few years. I'll pick up my classical brand
get your stripes,
and marketing skills. Yeah. And yeah, I'll get my brand manager stripe and I'll be gone. I was there, it seemed like a blink of an eye, but was there over 11 years. And I loved my experience there. It was professionally just such an important foundation for a lot of what else I've been able to do in life. And it was so rich from the experiences. We, as a family, we love Cincinnati. So I'd say the second important fork in the road is I was going to get promoted to general manager in Western Europe. And that caused us to take a pause and was looking forward on the one hand, going internationally. But both my wife and I do come from outside the US and had that experience. And so it really caused me to do something quite unusual for being so career-minded and ambitious. We decided to do something on a personal front. So the reason I left P&G had nothing to do with professional opportunities. It just had to do with we had our kids right after we were married. We were quite young when we had our kids. And we got to this stage where they were about to enter, my son was about to enter middle school. My daughter was finishing up elementary school. And we were kind of like, where do we want to finish raising them? And as much as we liked Cincinnati, we decided we wanted a more diverse cosmopolitan area. And so we actually picked the San Francisco Bay Area. And we made that completely on personal grounds. I mean, I ended up finding Clorox later, but it was really on this is where we wanted to raise our kids. And I'd say, I think often people feel like you have to sacrifice your family life or your personal goals for your career. And what I've always found is no, make sure that's a real priority in terms of what you want to do from a personal standpoint, from a family standpoint, and everything else takes care of itself. I mean, my experience at Clorox, you know, as much as I loved P&G, is just a wonderful experience at Clorox. In some respects, I almost called it, I'm sure they hate it when I say it, but a little P&G West. There are so many ex-P&G people there, similar value system, real love of brands, but in a smaller environment. And that was probably a second kind of realization for me. A third fork in the road for me was within Clorox, was when I made this shift from marketing to as a general manager over three of the divisions, litter, food, charcoal. And most people didn't even know they had those businesses, but they represented, you know, the majority of the economic profit of the company. And those were great experiences from a standpoint of being able to take Kingsford to like 85% share of the market, take a market share leadership away from Kraft with our Hidden Valley business, take our litter business to leadership there as well. And it also told me I was ready to run my own company or my own business. So the other fork was a leap into kind of this world of private equity backed mid-market growth companies versus big public companies. And so I'd say there have been a number of leaps through my career. I've never regretted any of them, even though at the time it felt quite risky.
Leaps are scary.
Yeah, leaving P&G and just heading out west or leaving Clorox for, you know, mid-market private equity-backed company.
Uncharted territory. Right?
Yeah. But those in some respects have been some of the richest experiences I've had and some of the biggest moments of growth.
Who have been some of your mentors over the year? And honestly, what have you learned from them? Are there any stories of things that kind of changed and helped you model your behavior?
Yeah, well, I mean, like most people, I've had so many great mentors over the year. It's hard to single any of them out. But since we are talking P&G, one from P&G that I'll call out is A.G. Laffley.
I've heard of him.
I developed my mentor relationship, our mentee relationship with A.G. back when, as I mentioned, I was on the Pantene business and was running Pantene in North America. A.G. had just returned from Asia and was running beauty. Pantene happened to be the biggest beauty brand P&G had at that time. And so I got to know him really just from a context of up my direct chain and started getting to know him first from a business standpoint as he was learning beauty and I had been in beauty for quite some time. And as we were then going through, I think, one of those walls that we'd hit on Pantene and working our way out of it. And then just got to know him on a deeper, more personal level. And I remember talking to him and I had not even realized what I was saying at the time, but I told him that Pantene had been such a great experience. Hair care had been a great experience. It had been great for me. But it had been 8 years I was on that business. And I thought for my own development, at some point, I should get another business. And he actually made it happen. He agreed. He said, you absolutely need to get a different type of business. And he was the one who made that Bounty experience possible for me. And I remember at the time he told me, he said, they're going through a tough time. This is going to be a really tough assignment, but those are the best type. Those are the ones where you're going to learn the most. And in return, he said, you're not losing me. You and I are going to stay connected. And wow. he stayed true to his word. I mean, we'd do these regular lunches. We got to know each other even better, where it became less formal and more where I could just walk up to his office and talk to him. And I remember another story related to that of kind of the importance of mentors is, as I mentioned, P&G went through a pretty rough transition when they went from Dirk Jager to AG. And in his first few weeks as CEO, I had one of those regularly scheduled mentor lunches. And I remember calling up Kathy King, assuming he had to be incredibly busy. There's no way in the world that he'd have time to have a mentor lunch with me. And she said, hey, hold on a minute. She got back on the phone and she said, actually, AG's wondering, instead of just lunch, would you mind walking stores with him? He wants to go out and walk stores with you. And I was like, yeah, of course. And so we went, I remember it was Northern Kentucky. We went, there used to be a race when I used to do store techs of how many stores could I hit in a given in a given day. And we spent the entire afternoon, we hit two stores. And it was such a great experience because he was, and what I realized at the time was, I was learning a ton from him. As usual, he was very much in teaching mode where he'd look at the cars and the traffic in the parking lot, look in the stores. And then we walked every single aisle. He showed me the difference between certain categories and how they were set up and what consumers were doing and the associates. And we'd stop and we'd talk to people. And we went through that. I mean, I think it was about 2 or 3 hours in, and he realized, like, hey, maybe we should, can I send the driver to get us a sandwich? Because we'd just been going. But he was also learning from me. He was asking me questions on different categories or how I was looking at things. And I think that was the best part of that relationship was I obviously learned a ton. I mean, he had so much. I remember his beliefs. It's something I've taken forward of kind of making sure I let people know what my beliefs are and those principles. And there's so much I learned from him. But in return, I think what made it a great relationship is there's things he learned from me. I mean, early on as he was CEO, I remember him calling me to his office one day and saying, Trang, I don't know much about the bounty business. So can you put together a series of, I had gotten good at those one pagers. Yeah. And of course, he went through everything. He's like, hey, can you tell me the history, the products, the competitive advantage? I mean, it started giving me a headache because I was realizing there went my entire week in terms of what we're going to do. And I got him those probably about 30 different pages on every aspect of the bounty business that he wanted. And then he sent that deck out to 20 other brands and asked for the same thing. And basically, that became his, what ended up being his billion-dollar brand book. And so it was a great relationship, mainly because it was two ways. To be honest, I certainly learned more from him than he ever would learn from me. But I think that's what made it really good, is he was learning things from me, I was learning things from him, and there was genuine value in terms of looking at different perspectives. And I've valued that in every mentor relationship I've had, or as I've now mentored others, in terms of being generous with your time, being finding places to connect other than the business knowledge that you have, and really making sure you're learning as much from your mentees as they're learning from you.
Yeah, another guest on the podcast once said, leadership is time inefficient. And I kind of wrote that one down because it was interesting, because it's investing time both ways. And it's clear that you're a really curious guy and you want to learn from people regardless of seniority. Now that, again, you're in the seat at ELF, can you share some of the things that you've learned from the folks in your organization as you've kind of shared mentorship and that mentorship goes both ways?
Oh, yeah. I'm learning more now, I think, than I've ever learned in my career. And it's almost inversely related in some respects. I learned a lot earlier in my career, but I learned even more now. Because as I said, I think one of the big differences is I'm much more open to, I can learn from anyone. P&G taught me the great opportunity of learn from what's best in class and kind of reapply that. And nobody cares if you created the idea. It's who brought the idea to the consumers and who leveraged it. And I find the same with people. I have an entire company full of young, diverse beauty enthusiasts. People are so much more into these categories than I ever will be. There's no secret that I would not be anyone's picture of a core beauty enthusiast, but I learned so much, and it's through our employees. It's through everything they have in terms of their passion. We move incredibly fast. We can launch new products as fast as 13 weeks from initial idea to selling online, on an average about 20 weeks. And a part of that is I'm part of, and the executive team's part of, our new product meetings every 2 weeks. So we make decisions, we move. But a big part of those meetings is not approving and disapproving. It's me actually learning from the core enthusiasts on our innovation team of why something is good. What's the core insight? What are we learning? I think in a couple of days, I have a Twitch 101 class that some of our younger employees are putting together for me as we continue to evolve. And they've did the same. I had my, I think it was last year or a couple of years ago, I had my TikTok tutorial. I had my Triller tutorial. I'm just constantly learning so much, and it actually makes my job that much richer. It makes me better at what I do, and in terms of kind of where we're going to put our bets and where we go. But I think that's actually been the most fun, is being able to learn from employees that are, they're younger than my kids' ages. And in some respects, I learn the most from them, because they just, they're so much more current, and particularly for a brand that appeals to Gen Z and millennials. It's really a lot of where I get my core insights is our team, and then our broader community, and looking at kind of our social feeds, looking at kind of what's going on in the industry around us and what other great, great brands are doing.
And now a word from our sponsor. Today, we're talking to Andrew Tarvin, co-host of the PNG Alumni Pod. Drew, wait, what's going on here, dude?
What do you mean, Roman? You're supposed to be asking me thoughtfully leading questions about my great new ad, Venture Up.
Oh, gosh. Has it really come to this, dude?
What do you mean?
Is this supposed to be like one of those public radio pledge drive ads?
I don't know what you're talking about, Roman. We don't have any tote bags yet.
Okay, then what the heck is this about?
Well, Roman, you know this podcast doesn't exactly pay for itself.
What? Are you trying to tell me that guest microphones and post-interview production doesn't grow on trees?
Sadly, no. And you and I do have day jobs and families, so we probably shouldn't be hand-delivering loaner microphones to John Pepper or Meg Whitman anymore.
We've come so far. I actually had a friend walk a microphone over to Edward Goh's house in Cincinnati once, and I even left one on Salesforce executive's porch.
Right. See, exactly. We've got to step up our game. And by now, you've heard some of the fantastic ads from a number of P&G alumni entrepreneurs. And we're grateful to all of our early supporters. But we also need your help, the listener, to step in too.
Yeah, each week, many of you, having worked at or never worked at P&G, tune in to hear learnings from leaders. And we want you to feature on an upcoming show.
This is a great way to let people know about your business. Past sponsors include independent advertising agencies, consultancies on both sides of the pond, software companies, fellow alumni podcasts, DTC and retail brands, and even organizations that do good, like the P&G Alumni Foundation and the Freedom Center.
Sponsor packages are affordable and flexible. They can be single episode sponsorships, or we can create multi-episode packages. Why not be the sponsor for a few months, and we might even have you on an episode if you've got the learnings. We can even create bigger integration packages with the broader P&G Alumni Network. I mean, we do know people.
Roman, aren't you still on the board of the P&G Alumni Network?
Well, after this ad, I'm not sure for how much longer, Drew.
Well, operators are standing by. We'd love to explore a partnership with you, our favorite listener.
Dude, you can't say that. John Pepper, our favorite listener, is listening.
Sorry, I meant our other favorite listener after John Pepper and my mom.
And my mom.
Yeah, so that makes that person the fourth favorite listener. So be a minch, sponsor the pod, and we may even throw in that free tote bag eventually.
Email us at pgalumpod@gmail.com. Let's have a chat, and we promise you'll never have to listen to a terrible ad like this again.
Roman, I think you meant to say a great ad like this. I mean, it was full of humor that works.
Drew, I think I now have to charge you as a sponsor.
I'll have my people call your people.
And now, back to our show.
So, I mean, related to the young folk, which I'm increasingly less of one now, but by the time you were my age, you were managing a lot of young professionals who are kind of entering this new life stage, new spouses, new families, new acceleration in the career. How have you found it best to kind of coach the next generation of kind of, I hate to use the word balance because that's not the right word anymore, but to kind of, how have you coached the next generation to kind of to weave the personal and professional together?
Yeah, I think some of it is each recognizing there's tremendous diversity in the people that we hire, and no person is same or has similar goals, what that looks like, than others. And so first and foremost, recognizing that diversity and really getting to know what people's goals are, what's important to them, getting to know who their families are, their significant others are, and what are they interested in, and how that goes. One, it gives you, I think sometimes people try to coach people without actually understanding who they are and what's important to them. So I'd say the first is really understanding what's important to them. And when you understand what's important in someone's either life goals or personally, you're much better able to kind of coach them on, hey, wait a minute, you said that coaching your kids' soccer thing was important. Why are you still here? I need you to go take care of that. That was an important objective. And so I'd say getting to know them first so you can actually coach them better. Second, story, as you can tell, I'm a big storyteller, and stories are powerful. And so I always tell the story of when I first joined P&G many years ago. In brand, there was a bit of you had to show that you're working hard, and the hours were really long. And I remember my wife, the first couple of years, kind of really complaining about that. But then we had this thing, which is really strange. I mentioned we had our kids early, and it was important to me that I was home in time for dinner. And so while many people are there way later, I ended up changing kind of my rituals where I would take, and we only had one car, and I'm not really sure why we only had one car, but I would take the bus in the morning, the first bus that got into downtown, and I basically would get a ton of work done in that first few hours, couple hours before anyone showed up. But then I wouldn't be there past 5. And I remember at first, a lot of people would be like, gosh, he gets out of here quite early. And whether I got in early and left early, kind of role model that in the beginning. And so I made a point of almost any new hire, kind of telling them like, hey, here's my own rituals and what I found works for me. That's different than what works for you. And I want you to find what your rituals are. Because in the end of the day, it's not about where you put time. It's particularly, I mean, I think we've learned this in spades during the pandemic, where I talked to other CEOs who were really adamant that everyone had to be in the office and they had to be together and that only then could work get done and collaborate. I think to a T, everyone's learned that there's multiple different ways people can accomplish work and achieve their goals. And it was good for me early on, kind of balancing family really early at that stage of one's career where you thought you had to put in the hours, and then having those conversations with my managers, with what we're doing and being able to show I could get things done and taking that. It also meant when I went to Clorox, having a very flexible, we had a number of professional women who join us after business school and were at that stage of their life where they wanted to have kids. I remember when I first got to Clorox, it was a pretty firm thing of if you came back from maternity leave or if you're only going to work part-time, you certainly couldn't manage any of the big brands. And I remember us doing job sharing where we take two women who want to do part-time and basically have them one work Monday through Wednesday, the other Wednesday through Friday, Wednesday being their overlap day, and then running. I had job shares for the biggest brands in my division. I had them on Clorox Bleach, on Clorox Disinfecting Wipes, on our health and wellness platform. And so I think get to know people so you can help understand what's important to them and you can support that. Two, recognize everyone's different and being more flexible into what works as long as it's working for the team. And so even on that job share, having that overlap day where it was seamless to the people that those people coached was absolutely important, that they were on the same page and the team was the same. And over time, I think if anything, it's just gotten more flexible. And also realizing flexibility often leads to people breaking barriers or boundaries between one's work and what's personal, right? People, I mean, I think it's probably the biggest complaint I hear right now is with this world of Zoom that we're on, when are you off and when are you not? And so I share a weekly kind of employee email, and I think probably a good third of the topics have just been on this, on how do you create those moments of rejuvenation and space and balance and making sure I'm talking about what's going on personally in my life and what we're doing. And so I'd say that creates that culture, which is like, no, they're not just saying it because everyone's supposed to say stuff on work-life balance. They actually mean it. And I'll talk even in my own routine where I tend to, during the pandemic in particular, I want to prioritize my health and wellness routine. So I'd like working out in the morning. So I'm not going to take meetings before a certain time unless I'm absolutely have to. And I want people to do the same thing. I want you to tell me what's important in your life. And as long as it works for the team. And what I found is teams are highly flexible. People will adjust. It's when they don't know what's going on that becomes tough. And so, yeah, again, I could probably go on and on this topic, but I've seen that to be a key enabler too. Because if things aren't right in someone's personal life, it's really hard to get the most out of them in their professional life. And so that's where balance comes in for me, is both have to be right. You have to have the right tools kind of at work and in your personal life, and both have to work. And only then can you really succeed.
Yeah, the kind of insanity of the past year, I think, is really exacerbated where people have things working and where people don't have things working. And so kind of communication has become way more important. I love this idea of not just your own rituals, but communicating the rituals and understanding what others are. So I guess I want to ask more about this year. It's been a weird one. It's been a challenging one. And leadership has been kind of all over the place in our societies. And someone who's clearly a curious people and purpose-driven leader, you've led large organizations. I mean, if you could give some advice to our leaders, what advice would you give them on how to think through not just where we've been in the past year, but how we have to move forward?
Be presumptuous for me to say I can give advice to other leaders other than some of the things that we've done, what I think have worked. One is reinforcing what we're about in our mission and our strategy. Two, making a commitment to the team. I think we're probably the only beauty company during this time that said, look, we worked hard building this team. We're committed not to do layoffs or other things. We're going to keep the team intact. And so we need the team to come together to figure out other places early in the pandemic where we could save money and do things so we could come out of this as a stronger team. And so I'd say being quite open and intentional of what your goals are. And so we talked about, first and foremost, we didn't know where the category is going. So let's make sure we had enough liquidity. Let's make sure we're strong from both not only a balance sheet standpoint, but financially too. Let's make sure this team was strong and taken care of. And then as we knew the team was facing a lot of things, it was those small gestures of care that actually reinforced it. It's funny, we pay out millions of dollars, many millions of dollars of bonus each year. But early in the pandemic, I remember saying, hey, people are going to suffer through extra initial, this is before we knew how long this was going to be. So we decided to give every employee another $1,000. And I got more notes on that $1,000 than the bonuses we give out each year, because it was a gesture of care that they're going through added costs and things they wanted. Early on, we secured masks, gloves, obviously through my connection with Clorox, disinfecting wipes, and we made it an open thing where every employee and their families would have as many of the personal protection things that they needed. We've stepped up our communication. And so I'd say being true to kind of like what your core objectives, making sure people knew them, that you reinforced it, making sure people know that you actually genuinely care as you go through, which goes hand in hand with stepping up our communication during this time. So, you know, I talked about, like, I started doing a weekly email. We do town halls every 2 weeks, and I actually like them better on Zoom. Everyone has their 2x2 square. The chat room goes crazy. We do dance parties. We do things of kind of keeping the team connected, even though everyone is remote. We get our leadership team, which is our directors and above, together every 2 weeks. They're insiders, so we can talk the business, the specific numbers. So what are we seeing? What are we doing? Where are we going? And so I think it's quite basic. There's nothing revolutionary in there. I think what is revolutionary is practicing these small rituals and making them more frequent, and so that you stay to it. And that's helped us. I mean, we're, I think, the only beauty company during the pandemic. The color cosmetics category has been down about 25%, and we've posted pretty strong growth, and we're growing a lot of share. And I attribute a lot of that to, we had a good strategy going into the pandemic. We're strong there, but we've continued to execute well and stay true to our core value equation and strategy. And the team has worked incredibly effectively, even through a very difficult time.
So we're recording this in early January. I guess, as we look into the new year, what excites you the most about the future?
Yeah, well, I'm always excited about the path ahead. And I think the one thing that excites me the most is, once we have enough vaccine out there, getting over the pandemic and having people be able to return to some level of normalcy. I think, selfishly, from a category standpoint, you know, I tell everyone that the color cosmetics category is going to come roaring back at some point, because everyone's been cooped up at home on Zoom. And at some point, there is a core consumer need to kind of get out and express yourself. And I think that'll be great for the category. I think it'll be great for the team. I'm so proud of how the team's done during the pandemic, but I frankly miss seeing everyone in person and having the teams kind of together. And our main offices are Oakland, California, New York, and Shanghai. And being able to go to each of those offices and spend time and kind of walk the halls. I mean, I'll do the impromptu virtual Zoom calls, but it's not quite the same as walking by someone's desk and chatting with them. And so I'd say, just like everyone else, just a real desire and appreciation for all those little things that we used to do and we took for granted, and perhaps not taking them for granted as much.
Yeah, I feel like that's been the thin silver lining of the past year, is really kind of a gratitude and appreciation of what we don't have right now and what we're missing and what we can't wait to get back to.
Exactly.
So we've got to wrap up in a few minutes, but I want to ask a few fun questions to get to know you even more.
Sure.
What's something about you that surprises people when they find out?
I'm a terrible dancer. I mean, it's actually quite embarrassing.
and yet you have the Zoom dance parties.
And we do. And I think it's so funny because they sometimes record those parties. And I think they go out of their way to pick the frame shots that show me dancing. And so, which is, I think, probably one of the other things, which is constantly pushing yourself outside your comfort zone, but it's embarrassing how poor a dancer I am and how much that's recorded.
That's why you have to get your Twitch training for your
live stream. Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
What's your go-to media escape? Are you more of a movies, books, or TV guy?
I'm a very heavy media consumer. It's my escape in all forms.
Is there a movie or a book that either you can relate to or that you like to recommend or gift to friends?
It's odd, but one of the movies I really like is The Shawshank Redemption.
And oh, man. I've wasted if 5 minutes of that are on television, you just have to stop everything.
I can't imagine how many times I've seen it. And in many respects, I can't relate to it because none of those things have happened to me. But the part I think I've always loved is the power of the human spirit to overcome any type of kind of the worst kinds of adversity. And so I find that quite inspirational. And then from a book standpoint, the one I probably give the most is Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals. And I think particularly at this time with kind of the political environment we're at, just going back and saying there's a time where it was much worse and just seeing the level of kind of leadership and character that was exhibited from Lincoln and in his cabinet. And I mean, I read that book 3 or 4 times and it's a go-to. It's kind of like The Shawshank Redemption. I can probably binge on that. And then on the TV side, I'm big on comedy. I love laughing. And so probably almost every comedian, Dave Chappelle is my favorite, but episodes of Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm, I probably binge watch that a bit too much. But as I said, a high consumer of media.
This one question has revealed how much we have in common. This is great. I feel on a bunch of my other podcasts, I always bring something back to Seinfeld. So I made an effort to not do it on this show, though. The world is going to open back up at some point. And where's the one place you want to go back to or where you want to go spend some more time?
Well, the one place I want to go back to is the Maldives. I think I just loved our time there and just back to being outdoors, kind of in nature and someplace that may not be there in the next few decades. And the one place I really want to go is the Londolozi Reserve in South Africa. And I'd heard a podcast recently with Boyd Vardy, who does this Track Your Life retreat there, where I think he's a world famous lion tracker, and they do these bush tracking journeys and just learning the ancient practice of kind of tracking what it helps you reveal about your own life and sensitivities and openness. And as soon as I heard that podcast, I'm like, oh my God, I need to get there with our entire family. So we'll see. At some point, we'll be able to do that.
Who's someone out there that you still want to get coffee with?
It'd have to be Dave Chappelle. I think I'm such a big fan of his. It's not just his comedy. It's just so insightful.
Yeah.
And the things that you look at the same thing, and I've always found value. If you're looking at the same thing, it's someone else's got such richer insight or meaning into it than what you're able to see. And so that'd be great to have a coffee with him.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw on Netflix, Letterman has his new show and he's got like a 1 hour long form conversation with Chappelle. I'd highly recommend it.
I did. That was wonderful. It was great to see him, particularly in his town and
in Ohio, right?
That. Yeah, exactly.
So we got to go in a second, but the last question, what's one final piece of advice or challenge, Tarang, that you'd give to the next generation?
Yeah, so I mean, I think obviously one of my themes is this curiosity point of be willing to learn from anyone, go out of your way to. But the advice I'd give from a professional standpoint is, for the last 15 years, I've used this high performance team framework for all of our teams. And I won't go through the entire concept here, but it really has 3 core elements of passionate relationships, really getting to know your peers really well, healthy conflict, the ability to give really great feedback and take feedback, and which leads to mutual interdependence. The part where I thought I did a pretty good job early in my career, but I'm much better at now, is the ability to give really pinpointed, specific feedback in the spirit of helping the team succeed and the individual succeed. It's made each of my relationships so much better, and it also makes people more open to giving me feedback. And I feel like that's often the thing that it's hard from a human nature standpoint. If there's something small to kind of give that feedback or talk about something of how something made you feel, And particularly early in one professional life, you feel like you got to be buttoned up and you got to know certain things and you do that. And that's been like the real unlock for me, I'd say, over the last 15 years is getting really, really good of understanding things, really great things happen when peers are working really well together, multifunctionally, in the same groups, across the enterprise. And that happens best when people really act like your best friend, where you get to know someone extremely well. You're not afraid to give them feedback. You're not afraid to take feedback from them. And I would say getting into that and kind of practicing that, both that framework and the ability of giving feedback, is probably the biggest piece of advice I'd give.
Wow. Well, Tarang, I've just loved this conversation, hearing your stories, your honesty and your candor. And honestly, it's all rooted in your curiosity. And I know we can't wait to keep hearing about the great things you and your team are going to be doing. So thank you so much for joining us on our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
Now here's a preview of next week's episode.
Work-life balance is a myth. I think you can have it all. I don't think you can have it all at once. You can look at my resume and see where I was getting majorly lapped by all of my peers. It slowed down while I was off having kids, and that was difficult to handle, but I was appreciative of the value and the parenting that I didn't have to compromise, because I was there for every single thing with my kids. I didn't miss one milestone, and I'm proud of that. What I did do during that time was a skill build. Let me do the work. Let me demonstrate and work towards my readiness. And then I accelerated pretty fast later on. Ultimately, in the long view, it all balanced out.
That's it for this week. I've been Roman Segal.
And I'm still Andrew Tarvin. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.